Speak in the name of God, the lover, the beloved, and the love sharer. Amen. Here at St. Martin's, we are finding ourselves between the joyful celebration of the success of opening our doors to the future, the capital campaign, and the launch of our annual stewardship drive for 2022. The capital campaign, beyond the dollar amounts raised, is an expression of the confidence of our present members in the faith they have for our future. Next week, we will officially launch the stewardship drive for 2022, and over the course of its 5 weeks duration, we will be asking our members to review and renew their estimate of giving so that we can effectively plan for 2022, which will be our 125th year. However, this review and renewal asks us to reflect on one question. Can we let our imaginations become the tools through which God's dreaming for the world can flow more freely? Can we let our imaginations become the tools for God's dreaming for the world to flow more freely? We find ourselves in what Susan Beaumont, in her insightful book, How to Lead When You Don't Know Where You're Going, she describes as a liminal season. A liminal season is a shoulder season, a time in between. How do we proceed between an ending and a new beginning? When the old way of doing things no longer works, but the way forward is not yet clear. It's not only the church, but our wider society that we find ourselves in a liminal time when the continuity of tradition disintegrates and uncertainty about the future fuels doubt and chaos. In a liminal season, it is simply not helpful to pretend that we understand what needs to happen next. Prophetic words for us in this moment of history. And we as a community here at St. Martin's endeavour to occupy a place of tension, weathering the uncertainty of the times through a commitment to traditional worship combined with radical theological messaging that recognises and attempts to speak into the uncertainty of the time. We are all watching as the stalwart generation of faithful members pass on to their next great adventure, and we wonder who is coming up behind them to take their place. Our fear that we are on a trajectory of decline fills some of us with despair, while provoking in others manic attempts to delay what we all fear is inevitable. Last week I offered a very overarching and sweeping overview of the themes to be found in the book of Job, a book that offers one of the most profound explorations of the nature of human suffering in the face of a God who seems often to us uninterested in our plight, a God who from our experience remains silent in the face of humanity's age-old question, why? And in today's portion from the book of Job, we hear him exclaiming, Oh, that I knew where I might find him, that I might come to his dwelling. In other words, we can read this as, oh, what I wouldn't give to know that God is really there. Words that remind us of the partial nature of our knowledge and the narrowness of our perspective of our vision. You see, like Job, our vision is clouded with self-preoccupation, protests of self-importance, cutting us off from the divine energy for renewal. So much of our vision, both individually and in community, is hedged in by our need for assurance, for reassurance. We strain to hear a false note of security, a grasping for knowledge as a defense against the uncertainties of the future. Job continues, I would lay my case before him and fill my mouth with arguments. I would learn what he would answer me and understand what he would say to me. Would he contend with me in the greatness of his power? No, but he would give heed to me. There an upright person could reason with him, and I should be acquitted forever by my judge. This is the nub of Job's complaint. I am an upright person. You must hear me. And eventually God will respond to Job, but in rhetorical metaphors that exposes the human dilemma. We cannot know what we feel we need to know. We fill the vacuum in our knowledge with simplistic answers, such as leading a charmed life is a sign of God's favor, and suffering means God's punishment and abandonment. Feeling alone and abandoned in an indifferent universe, we cast ourselves even further adrift when we conclude that because our suffering is not instantly alleviated, the miracle that we demand on cue is not delivered, that we no longer cease to matter to God. In the end, God responds to Job by effectively sidestepping his complaint. God will not meet Job's complaint by justifying the divine action or inaction. Instead, we will hear God reminding Job of the paradox of his quest for omniscience, to know the entirety of things. God tells Job, or he asks Job, where were you when I laid the foundations of the world? Tell me if you have understanding who determined its measurements. Surely you know. Who laid the cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the heavenly beings shouted for joy? The truth is, as Job discovered, we cannot know the entirety of things. We cannot know the future except in outline glimpsed through a glass darkly. Yet journeying into the future has never required us to know where we're going. Now, I know we like to pretend that we often do know where we're going, but the fact of the matter is that we have never yet known the future before it arrives. And in this lies a ground for hope. Instead of being preoccupied with our own construction of a future, either of doom and gloom or of brittle and false certainties, can we let our imaginations become tools through which God's dreaming for the world can flow with greater freedom? What matters is what we do in the present time, the quality of the stories that guide us and propel us to action. Our future lies in the mind of God and always has done. Now, if we learn anything from the practice of a spiritual life, it's this. God's surprises are so much more exciting and fulfilling than anything when left to the impoverishment of our own imaginations we could predict or plan for ourselves. Job is a book in three parts. There's a prologue and there's an epilogue. And as I explained last week, these appear to belong to the same story. And in between the vast section of the book is a complex exploration of human suffering. Job's experience of suffering is not senseless, though he protests and demands that God show him its meaning. But God never gives Job an answer to his insistent question of why. And many see in this a refusal to satisfy Job's demand, a suspicion that maybe God can't give Job a satisfactory answer. One of the things I noted last week was that in the arrangement of the Tanakh, the Jewish arrangement of the Old Testament books, after Job, God is forever silent. From then on. But between the prologue and the epilogue of Job, the beginning and the ending, lies the experience for Job of being changed, albeit by some pretty awful suffering. But maybe this is the purpose of Job's suffering. A catalyst for change. And in the beginning, before Job has everything he cherishes taken from him, he believes that his prosperity reflects his own greatness, his own wonderfulness. In this, he is a great icon for many of today's obscenely wealthy one percenters, not to mention many of us lesser mortals. And the book ends with God's restoration to Job, not simply of his original wealth taken from him, but of a magnification of that wealth tenfold. But Job is not the same man he was before. Suffering has changed him, and he now understands his wealth to be as a sign not of his greatness, not the fruit of the sweat of his own brow, but of God's generosity. He now understands that his wealth is no longer his, but it is a sign of God's gift to him. And Job's response to God's generosity is gratitude. How might any of us express gratitude? We do so by a dedication and commitment to live into the allotted span of our lives with greater generosity. Job, in the end, does something unheard of. As a sign of his gratitude and of his changed understanding, he rewrites his will. He settles portions of his estate on his three daughters, as well as his male heirs. In the time in which this story is set, this action would have been unthinkable beyond the capacity of the ancient patriarchal imagination. We see here how the expansion of Job's understanding unlocks his imagination that allows God's generosity to flow more abundantly than before. Can anything be clearer? A clearer demonstration of Job as a changed man. Living amidst the uncertainties, the fears, the doubts, not to mention the violence of a liminal time, we might pay greater attention to our part in the unfolding of God's dream for the world. The flow of God's dreaming for the world requires two things from us. The first is a capacity to be endlessly curious. Curiosity is a tremendous antidote when facing into fear and doubt. And the second thing is a willingness to be changed in the direction of becoming more fit for God's purpose. Amen.